Hello everybody, for one final time in this 2020-2021 season, welcome back inside the Shark Tank as we do our end of season review and rule the roost over sales fortunes over the last 10 or so months. My name is Lewis and I'm delighted to say I'm joined as always by my co-hosts Alex and James. Alex, how are you?
I'm very good, mate. Looking forward to reviewing the season.
James, how are you?
Fab, mate. Absolutely fab. Pleased to be reviewing a very successful season.
Well, exactly. I think this time last year, or the equivalent for the end of last season pod, we were talking about COVID completely derailing our last month of the season. So it's nice to be in a slightly different position this time around. So for our listeners, the format for today is going to be, we're going to go through the season chronologically, chat through the key events. There's obviously been quite a few of them, and you don't realise how many there have been until you start looking into it. We're going to wrap things up with a bit of a discussion on whether the season was a success, hand out some end of season awards, and I've actually come up with a little quiz to finish things off to see how well my co-hosts have remembered the last sort of 10 months or so. So we'll see. So I want to start this discussion with something that actually feels like a lifetime ago now, and it actually falls slightly before the season began. But that was the news in September 2020 that the Crossford Bridge project, so the plan to have a brand new stadium for the club at the Crossford Bridge site in Sale, had actually fallen through as Trafford Council wasn't prepared to move the project forward. So Alex, you know, we're going to talk, you know, next 90 minutes over a lot of stuff happening on the field. But in terms of off the field, this is arguably one of the biggest things that happened this year because it's such a significant impact on where the club can go in the next 5 or 10 years. And as someone who's probably the most local to Sale now, you know, what was your kind of takeaway now that you've had such a long time to think about it in terms of the ultimate failure of that project?
I just think it's such a massive shame for both the club and for Sale as a town. You know, I think the kind of the investment and the activity it would have brought would have really boosted a lot of growth that's going on there anyway. And for the club, I just think it would have made such a difference to things like attendances and obviously all the kind of being able to run our own club. And we've had, I think what's interesting is you think if the kind of everything had followed suit and Alex Sanderson still come in this season, having Sanderson and that new stadium in kind of retrospect would have been such a good pairing to drive the club forward, along with Orange and Mason at the top and Sid Sutton coming in as chairman. I think he would have had a really, really great setup, and you still have one, but it has forced us down the path of buying the AJ Bell, which has forced us to fall out with another sports club because Salford Red Devils now, fans all now despise us apparently. So I think, you know, it's absolutely huge for the club to not have that opportunity. And I come back to it, it's such a massive shame. And, you know, you think about the ease of getting there and what you could have built in that space. It's, you know, I think there were rightly some objections to the idea, but the fact that those objections weren't even allowed to be sort of thought through and discussed remains a massive shame. But I think it's just proved to the club that, you know, you never trust a council and try to deal with them as little as possible, because, you know, we've had real struggles with Salford City Council for the last 10 years or however long we've been at the AJ Bell now. And equally, we've had massive struggles with Trafford Council. So I don't know which local authority there is left to go to, because I can't imagine Stockport are that much of a fan of us either.
Well, I mean, that was something I wanted to ask James about, because, you know, we've done a podcast on this news about 10 months ago. But James, you know, as we sort of think about the long-term future of the club, I mean, are there any alternatives that you can think are on the table at the moment for Sale?
I don't think so. I think it's buying the AJ Bell or nothing. I mean, not being able to get... I mean, it's just a massive missed opportunity from the council, from the community and from the club to get us back to Sale. And, you know, it would have transformed that the town. It would have transformed the feeling of the club, really family community club. You know, you look at what Saracen's done. They had to fight tooth and nail to get to Barnet. And look at what they're doing now. And they've got an academy and all the rest of it. I think we approached it not as well as we should. We took promises from political leaders as enough. And actually, at the first hurdle, the leader of the council pulled the plug. And it was a pretty disgraceful thing. I mean, we never even got to the stage of publishing plans. So they never got to the stage where they could sell it well by having the designs, saying what they were going to be doing. It was just an initial consultation. They pulled the plug before it even got going. Now it's been designated as Greenbelt land or something now. So it'll never, that part of sale will never be built on. So unless there's another plot of land, which I very much doubt, well, I don't think we'll ever get back to sale. I think it's just, I mean, look, we spoke about it at the time, but it's probably the worst news of this year, because even if we did buy the AJ Bell and we make a success of it, it's not a spiritual home and will never be. And it's just very sad that, you know, the sale sharks aren't wanted in sale. And I think that is a crying shame, especially as we're, you know, in sort of semi-finals now and, you know, very competitive.
Well, obviously, we can't control, as a club, what happens off the field, but we can control what happens on it. And we want to kind of pivot now to actually the start of the season. So obviously there's some plenty of big news that we want to get to, but very briefly, we want to kind of just cast everyone's minds back to November 2020 and some of the early season form that Sale had. So coming into the season, finishing fifth last year due to COVID and not getting that playoff spot. Sale come in with reasonably high expectations to make that push into the top four, led, of course, by Steve Diamond. And the early season form is okay, you know, beat Saints at home, 32 points to 23. There's then that loss to Falcons away at Kingston Park, 15-13, and then it follows up with a win over at Irish, 21 points to 13. So I think, Alex, not too much to take away from there, apart from that loss to Newcastle, which I think, given the fact that we, you know, went down to Irish and won comfortably, or reasonably comfortably, beat Saints at home reasonably comfortably, you know, already you're looking at that loss to Falcons and thinking, it was that our worst performance of the season?
Yeah, and I think you have to remember at that time as well, you know, Falcons ended up finishing basically the bottom of the league, didn't they? But actually, those first 6 weeks, they were so fresh compared to everyone else because they had a season in the Championship not really playing, that they just kind of ran riot a bit, didn't they? And they beat a lot of big names. And you know, if anyone follows Fab Rugby and looks at those graphs that sort of chart teams' positions through the season, you just see Falcons like second, third, and then it is just like falls off a cliff for the rest of the season. So they were a good team at that time. And, you know, again, you come back, we probably should have won that game because it was a last-minute Toby Flood try in the corner that wasn't checked by the TMO, but I'm over it. And, you know, if we defend that, then it's a really good start to the season. But going to Newcastle and winning is always really difficult. And I think, especially when they were in that form and they were so fresh, you know, having those kind of that rest before the season that the rest of the teams didn't have. It was disappointing, but I think you can understand it. So actually, when you look at that as a start to the season, if you kind of, you know, where we are now, we look back and go, we're a top four team, we should be winning away at Newcastle, who finished 11th or 10th. But where we were then, you look, you know, we're a top six team and we win our home games. And if we can pick up a few away wins, that'd be great. Newcastle is such a hard place to go away and win. And when they were in good form, I think, you know, it was, but when you look at the actual game, you know, you do come back to, we probably should have seen that one out because it was a last minute try that you know, we probably could have avoided if we'd played a bit more sensibly. But I think it's a mark of the development of where the team has come to now that we'd go to that ground and we'd win that game. And we'd probably win it very comfortably, or at least we'd show a load of mental resilience and keep them out in the final minute. And I think that's been the difference later in the season, but I don't want to get too ahead of myself.
Well, I mean, I think we're going to have to start moving in that direction anyway, because we're three games into the season, slightly up and down form, but generally, on the whole, pretty good. And then we come to arguably the biggest off-field moment of the and on-field moment of the season, which is that after 10 years effectively helming the club, Steve Diamond was stepping down from his director of rugby duties. Now, this was very much out of the blue. You know, Dimes was someone who, for all his faults, was someone who bled for the club. He was someone who very firmly embedded in them. Let's not forget, he played a massive role in getting the current ownership into investing in the team. But early December, the news breaks that Steve Diamond is going to leave his post with immediate effect. all of a sudden taking away some of the stability that's been a hallmark of Celt for the past sort of decade. So James, I mean, again, we did a podcast on this, we spoke about it at length, but you know, in hindsight now, with a bit more time to digest the news, I mean, has your initial thoughts about Dimes leaving and what that meant for the club changed at all?
A little bit, because in that immediate time afterwards, you know, we went on a bit of a losing trot until Axe was actually appointed. Remember, we had Paul Deacon appointed as sort of acting head coach. I think he has now been appointed head coach, actually, but no director of rugby above him. And, you know, it really did unsettle us. And I think we were very fortunate that we went into Champions Cup games. I think if we'd had to suddenly play three Premiership games in a row, that would have really affected our ability to finish in the top four. So we actually almost had, you know, that opportunity to get Axe in. And then once you've got that new coach, although it takes some time to bed in, etc., you get that immediate, I've got to impress the new coach thing going on. But it was a bit of a shake-up because we had that good start to the season. We'd literally just won away at Irish, which is, you know, not, and don't forget there was a crowd in Irish. This is before the second lockdown. So, it was a massive shock to the system. And I think that anybody who was so ingrained in the club, it was going to take time to sort of fill that void. Now, I think it's quite interesting that, you know, Sanderson's a big enough character where he's been able to do that. So with hindsight, it hasn't affected us as much, but you put yourself back in the shoes there. It shocked the whole sort of rugby community in the country. We knew it was going to create opportunities in terms of rebuilding relationships with the press, things like that. But we were very worried, of course, about the way it would impact on the stability of the club. And, you know, let's not beat around the bush. You know, we've said this before, we've got the club has just, you will always be massively thankful for Steve Diamond. As the years go on, it'll only strengthen how thankful we are. At the moment, we're just sort of seeing the impact in 1 year. But over the course of like a decade, he really did save the club. I do think that Alex has said that a few times before, but I save the club and save professional rugby in the Northwest. It sounds outrageous, but I think it genuinely is true.
So I've got two questions for you on this. In terms of kind of off-field news, where over the last sort of decade, where would you put Dimes leaving? Like the pantheon of like off-field movers and shakers.
What, for sale or for anyone in the Premiership?
For sale, let's keep it sale-focused.
Yeah. I mean, I think it might not... It depends what happens in the new ownership era. I think Kennedy going and then, you know, new investment coming in will probably be seen as the bigger turning point. But I think in terms of the biggest shock, yeah, I think this was the biggest shock, for sure.
And my second question is, now that we've had a bit of time to think about it, I mean, where would you put Steve Diamond in terms of the pantheon of the modern club? I mean, do you have him down as probably a top three, top one most influential person in terms of the, you know, the club since they turned professional?
I think the owners, both Kennedy and the new owners, probably deserve to be the number one slot, because without that, there isn't a professional rugby club, full stop. After that, it has to be Steve Diamond. There's no one that comes close to Sale. I mean, there isn't. We've had, you know, people like Pete Anglesey and stuff like that who have given great service to the club. But I mean, Steve Diamond. I mean, there's been no Sant Andre. I suppose was an excellent coach, but no one's had the kind of rooted impact. And you know, yeah, no one's got close to him.
I mean, Alex, I mean, just quickly, where do you kind of stand on Diamond leaving 10 months on or however long it's been?
Well, I think in hindsight, it's 2020, and in hindsight, it was a great decision, wasn't it, for everyone in the club? And I think there is part of what Dan said when he left, and again, we come back to, we don't know how much of that is true and what else has gone on behind the scenes, but he said, "I've taken this club as far as I think I can take it," and you know Sanderson's effectively proved him right, hasn't he? And I do think there's an element of that. You've seen such a step change in kind of mentality and just the little areas that Sanderson's brought in that it was absolutely the right thing to do. And you know, as James has said already, and I will say, you know, Dimes bringing in Simon Orange and Jed Mason. With, you know, without that, this club is nowhere. You know, you wouldn't get Sanderson because you wouldn't have the money to bring him. Tom Curry and Ben Curry would have left because we wouldn't have been able to sign them on long-term contracts. You know, a host of other academy talent would have left. It would have been, you know, it would have been fighting tooth and nail to survive. And if they're not brought in, then Dimes probably has got great reason to stay because, you know, that's what he's brilliant at. He's brilliant at taking a club with, you know, not enough resources and beating the odds. Whereas what Sale have got now is enough resources and we've got to match the odds. You know, we've got to deliver on the talent that we promised. So it was obviously huge. And I think at the time it was a shock. And we then had that little bump after Sanderson came in and it felt, and that is still going on really, isn't it? You know, I wouldn't say Alex Sanderson's honeymoon period is over. He took us to a Premiership semi-final and within a whisker of a Premiership final, really, in the grand scheme of things. But I think, yeah, James is right. As we look back, no coach comes close because Saint Andre won us the league, but he didn't do the other things for the club that that Diamond did. You know, Diamond led the club and then brought in the owners to support that, whereas Kennedy brought in Saint Andre to say, right, win a title. Once you've won the title, that's kind of it. You know, money goes and you probably go with it. So I think it's absolutely huge and it will continue to define Sale for a long time. And, you know, the characteristics that Dimes put into that squad. And you know, don't forget, Sanderson hasn't really bought any players other than potentially a couple that have appeared on the Wikipedia page recently. But this is Diamond's squad and it's Diamond's playing style to a large extent, tweaked by Sanderson. You know, the defence is Diamond's through Forshaw. The attack is Diamond's through Deacon. He's brought all those people in as well. So you've got a coaching staff that are built by Diamond, a playing staff that are built by Diamond, and a backroom staff that have been built by Diamond as well. So everything about this club will continue to be Steve Diamond influence for a long, long time. And you know, if it does change, I think it won't be for 5 or 6 years. So we're going to feel the influence of that for a long time. So, you know, I think that kind of probably is the best way of speaking to how much he did for the club. And, you know, what a big loss it was at the time. And we, I think we have to recognise how lucky we are that we've got someone in the calibre of Sanderson. And probably also give credit to Sid Sutton and Simon Orange and Jed Mason for going out, finding Sanderson and bringing him in, because it looks like a really good appointment so far.
Well, I'm glad you both mentioned somebody there that was a long-standing member of Steve Diamond's team, and that's obviously Paul Deacon. So as we work through the season chronologically, Diamond leaves, huge shock, and it's Paul Deacon, rather than Mike Forshaw or Pete Anglesey or anyone else, who steps up as the interim head coach. So he's in charge between December and January, and there's 5 games. So as you mentioned, James, we're quite fortunate in a sense that the immediate games after Diamond's leaves are in the Champions Cup. So it starts with a loss away at Toulon. It starts with a loss at home to Edinburgh. There's then a return to Premiership action, and it's a loss to Wasps at home, and then 2 wins over Gloucester and Worcester, which in hindsight obviously are indicative of where those two teams finished end of the season. So Alex, obviously, you know, there's this kind of spectre hanging over the club. Diamond's left. There's lots of talk about who's going to come in as a director of rugby. In the meantime, Paul Deacon has to step up and kind of lead the team through Champions Cup and some Premiership games. I mean, what did you think of, you know, what is the assessment of Deacon's time, albeit very briefly, in charge of the club?
Yeah, it's very odd, isn't it? Because you look at the Champions Cup and obviously, you know, we were never going to win away in France. So you can't really judge on that. And then we obviously lose at home to a not great Edinburgh side. So it doesn't look that good. But, you know, we got a bonus point out of it. And as things tend to do in Sale, the world works in mysterious ways and we end up in the Champions Cup quarter final as a result. So is it a success? Obviously, that those Champions Cup games, and I think you have to split it in Champions Cup and Premiership, don't you? The Champions Cup wasn't a success. I think the Premiership, actually, was a relative success. You know, to go away to Gloucester and yes, again, a very poor Gloucester team, but, you know, look at where Sale were in a kind of holistic view. They were, you know, we didn't have a head coach and we were kind of all at sea. And to show the resolve and the kind of mental fortitude to get that win, I think was massive. And then, you know, again, we unconvincingly beat a very poor Worcester side who ended up not winning a game all season other than the first round of the season. So we did what we had to do. And I think the difficulty of the task on Paul Deacon's hands can't be understated with the upheaval and his lack of experience. I think you have to say that to deliver two Premiership wins, which kept us in the hunt in that league, is the absolute maximum we could have done. You know, we're not going to see the side suddenly throwing the... We're not like Quinns, where you just take out a DLR and all of a sudden we're the best team in the world. We are quite a structured team, and I think we've relied on, especially Diamond, off-field influence to change our tactics, change our game plan, and to react to stuff. So, I think I would have it as a massive success compared to what could have been, certainly. And I think, as I say, that those two wins in the Premiership felt like, just another win in the Premiership away at Gloucester and home to Worcester. But, you know, we won an away game, which is a rarity for Sale. And come the end of the season, that got us into the top four, didn't it, those two wins? So, I think he did a brilliant job. And I think he's then continued to excel under Sanderson. So I think he's probably all the better for it as well.
So, James, you know, we're always kind of thinking, you know, long term and thinking, you know, okay, you know, who could be next to step up into these sort of roles? And obviously Deacon, as you mentioned, is now sort of head coach under Sanderson. But from that kind of five game run, do you think we've kind of seen the green shoots of Deacon taking on a high performance role either at Sale or another club in the future? Or do you think the jury's still out in terms of his prospects at making that step up from attack coach to head coach or DOR?
I think the jury's still out, but I don't think it's door shut, I think is the way I would suggest. I think, you know, you've got to remember that, you know, that loss at home to Edinburgh really was like an absolute low point. And then obviously losing away at Wasps before that, those Gloucester and Worcester games, where I think we basically just eked it through kind of on just willpower and a bit of luck. Before that Gloucester game, it did feel like the wheels were actually completely off. You've got to remember, like, Diamond wasn't just a shock to the media and to the fans. It was a massive shock to the players, and they played like it had been a shock. So I think that Deacon had a very difficult set of circumstances there. And, you know, as a personality, he was never going to fill the Diamond void in terms of personality. And even the way he interacted with the press, it was all the questions were about Steve Diamond. You know, or him thanking Steve Diamond and all of this kind of stuff. And it just didn't feel like anyone expected him to get the role. And actually, the other thing that's really suffered in that time was our attack. So it's not to say that he can make the step up and bring in his own attack coach, of course. But I think it just led to some question marks about his sort of core competency, which is attack coaching. And actually, since Axe has come in, we have seen an improvement again towards the end of the season with our attack, which both Deacon and Sanderson deserve, I think, a lot of credit for. So I think there's as many questions as there was answers about Deacon's ability to step up. But I think it says quite a lot about his ability. We always hear about how well-respected Deacon is as an attack coach. Cipriani used to talk about it. You know, clearly Diamond was a big fan, and Sanderson doesn't look like he's going to be changing that coaching position anytime soon. So, you know, he clearly is a coach of high ability. I think he's probably got some work to do around leadership from a coaching point of view. I know he used to captain him with the league when he was playing. So, yeah, I'll go back to the way I answered the question first, which I think is the most sensible way, which is jury is still out, but the door's not closed.
I think that's a pretty fair summation of those five games in charge. And thankfully, or, you know, depending on your perspective, Deacon didn't actually have to spend that much time as the head honcho at Sale, because January 2021 sees the appointment of Alex Sanderson, you know, former Saracens defensive forwards coach, coming back to the club that he played at 20 years ago to take on the director of rugby role. Now, I'm not going to kind of, you know, round table on, you know, was he a good hire? Because we know he's a good hire with the benefit of hindsight. At the time, we all thought he was a great hire. You know, Sanderson was very rightly regarded as one of the hottest coaching prospects in the game because of the work he'd done at Saracens. So I actually just want to kind of push things forward a little bit and talk about those first four games, actually, with Axe in charge. So he joins the club in January 2021, mid-season. The team has very much been put together by Steve Diamond and co. And the first four games, it's a win away at Leicester Tigers. It's a win away at Bristol Bears, who were leading the league at that point. And then it's two actually consecutive losses at home to Bath and away at Harlequin. So, James, you know, I remember doing loads of pods on this, you know, back in January. We were all super excited for Sanderson, for obvious reasons, the coaching prowess, the media darling status, you know, the fact that he's a former Sale player, he's a local lad, all that kind of stuff. Comes in and has two fantastic results, you know, to start the season. I think that Tigers win away from home in particular was impressive, given the fact that it was day five of him, you know, being the coach or whatever. And it's followed up by two losses on the bounce. And you know, what did you make of those kind of first set of four games for Axe? And what did you kind of notice seemed to change around the club from Diamond to Deacon to Sanderson in those early days?
Well, actually, on paper, it looks very similar to the kind of form we had last year and at the beginning of this season, which is a bit topsy-turvy. You know, like the ability to put in some good performances, a couple of good wins, but, you know, not scoring huge amounts of tries. We were talking quite a lot at the time, weren't we, about, you know, we never score above 25 points, you know, and sort of two tries in a game. It's not possible. What we saw at Bristol, though, I think, was this green shoots of a level of intensity in that game. We played that every time we played Bristol this season, but like in that game, it was exactly the same. We just absolutely squeezed the life out of Bristol in that game. And they just couldn't cope with the intensity that we brought. So it felt like we'd taken sort of Forshaw's defence, which was always excellent under Steve Diamond, but just increased that intensity, you know, that sort of the dominant collision, the dominant tackle. Really felt like we were coming through, and you know, we felt okay. Well, actually, we can really play with the big boys here. So I think maybe with hindsight, we saw some green shoots. But actually, after that Harlequins loss, and certainly that Bath loss at home, which you know we got out muscled and out thought really, and you know, really taking us a batch of four games, really not that much difference to what we experienced under Diamond the year before, which is we were clearly a good side. We had the ability to put in a good performance, but we couldn't get that level of consistency to put it in, week out. So that if we're just looking at these four games, that's what I would say. Still, you know, Sanderson's still getting his eye in, basically. I mean, he's had to come in and hit the ground running. And actually, it probably wasn't until after that, you know, we really saw a change to the sort of the fabric, the culture of the club.
I mean, Alex, I guess it's the same question for you. It's, you know, that those first four games, you know, the sort of early signs that we were seeing from a Sanderson-led team, did anything stand out even with the benefit of hindsight now?
I think when you look back, we had no choice other than to kind of base our game on our defence at that point, didn't we? I mean, you remember Dan Thomas throwing his toys out the pram after the Bristol game because we were a boring team to play against. And you know, looking back, not that there was any truth in it because we were just better than them and he was bitter, but you know, our attack certainly didn't have the kind of the swagger and the verve that it did at the end of the season when we played Bristol again and we comprehensively beat them. And I think, you know, it was quite sensible of Sanderson there to kind of base it on our defence, which was obviously a massive strength. But it did mean we were vulnerable to teams like Bath, where you've got pace, like De Glanville, which James mentioned before the game. And as I watched him run in, I went, James is going to be spitting. That Quinns game, you know, that's the prime example of you can't win collisions against someone who's faster than you if they've got a load of space and they can run around you on a dry track on a nice day. And that's what Quinns did. They just found the space, they found out wide, they made the passes and they exposed not necessarily a weakness in our defensive game, but you know, we deliberately leave a big hole in our defensive line on the wings. And if you can get that pass over the top, which not many people can, but Marcus Smith can, then we're in massive trouble. So I think that was clearly the key bit. I mean, you know, the win away at Bristol was massive, and I think he definitely got the sense of a bit of a step change around the club in terms of being able to win away from home. You know, to have two away wins on the bounce, probably, when was the last time we did that? I don't know, and I'm sure I can find out. But it felt like that was quite big in those Leicester and Bristol games, and obviously a massively tough instruction. And I think Sanderson, you know, don't forget Sanderson was kind of working out his rotation policy, and that had a massive change because we played a full strength team virtually for Bristol and then made, you know, 9 or 10 changes against Bath. And that's probably why we lost that game. But that meant that come the end of the season, we had this really good rotation policy in place where we were seeing players turn over game to game. And actually we were able to put out, injuries aside, we could have put out our full strength team, you know, kind of a couple of weeks in a row, even with a few changes in certain positions. So, you know, I think it was certainly necessary to kind of, it's one of those where the losses had to come at some point, and actually to come at that early stage in the career, it probably then set us in good stead for the rest of the season. Because as that rotation policy got worked out and got refined, we then saw the benefits of that later on. So, you know, it was frustrating to lose against Bath, and it was always frustrating to lose against Quins. But looking back, that Quins team were on red hot form. And I think the Bath is the one where you go, this is a blip. And, you know, to get outthought by Stuart Hooper isn't great. So it was then good to kind of go and get a bit of revenge on them later in the season.
I think the one thing from this first set of games that I did want to mention as a kind of step change that we saw was the inclusion of two players in those games against Bath and Quins. The first is obviously Conor Doherty playing at 12, just handed kind of a start a little bit out of the blue. I know Sale kind of had, you know, injury issues in the midfield, and Diamond, to his credit, has never been someone to kind of shy away from blooding the kids. But there was always this kind of feeling it was out of necessity rather than by choice. You know, it's because our academy is relatively strong and our first team wasn't, you know, back in 2015. And, you know, we had to, you know, fill a 23. Here, there were probably multiple options you could have done. You could have played, you know, Rob Dupree at 12, for example. You can move things around in the back line. But, you know, Sanderson, you know, made a massive call to play Doherty at 12. He didn't necessarily have a great game, but, you know, that was the first time we saw something that became a bit of a theme towards the end of the season, which was Sanderson not being afraid to throw these very young players into high-pressure situations and see how they perform. The second one is obviously in that game against Quins, and it's the, you know, debut for Rafi Quirk coming off the bench. Again, another kind of huge call, not playing one of your two more established scrum halves. Obviously not playing, you know, either, you know, Gus War or any of the other nines in the system. It was very much a case of, he's ready, he's good enough, it's time for him to play. And obviously Quirk had a storming debut and obviously went on to be, you know, one of the more interesting storylines of the season. So I think in those early games, the main thing you saw from Sanderson as a bit of a step change from the old regime was this willingness to throw these young players in, even without there being a kind of pressure or a need to. So Sanderson gets off to a pretty decent start. The next three games I just want to touch on very briefly. So it's a win at home to Exeter, 25-20, obviously marked by the Jack Yandel red card. A win at home to Falcons, 31-16, and then a loss away at Saints, 17-14. James, talk about how good that win against Exeter was and what a marker it was for the team. And then I'm going to go to Alex to talk about probably one of our worst defeats of the season again, away at Saints. So, James?
So that was the game with the red card, was it? Yeah. I mean, it helps, doesn't it, when you're playing against 14? And it wasn't easy even against 14. Sorry, Alex, go on.
As it turns out, it doesn't actually help playing against 14. It makes it more difficult, if anything. I think we saw that in the last year.
Well, no, you have to go down to 13 to really get the boost, as we've found. but I think maybe our games against Exeter at the end of the season, the two back-to-back games, showed the difference that 15 over 80 minutes get it sort of has for them, at least against us. But no, look, I mean, it's good to beat the champions at home. And what was important about this structure of games, I mean, is just that we sort of get on a bit of run with the Falcons win. We slip back a bit against Saints. But look, you know, away from it, it wasn't a good performance. I think that's what we can all say. That Saints away game was a really poor performance. But actually, to still get a losing bonus point, just kept us moving forwards in terms of points accumulation. And actually, when you actually have a look at the rest of the games that we then, the sort of the run that we go on in the Premiership, it's actually a blip. It becomes a blip rather than the return to inconsistency. When you actually look at this block and you look at the next block, you realise that actually that Saints game is just a bit of a blip in terms of performance, but actually their mental strength on the pitch is already starting to improve, and we still walk away with a losing bonus point. So that's the way that I view that batch of games.
So, I mean, Alex, I asked you earlier, that game away at Falcons, arguably our worst performance of the season. I think that Saints one must come pretty close, though.
Yeah, well, I think that Saints one was certainly the nadir of our attacking performances. You know, I just remember us constant. All I can think of in that Saints game, and all I can picture, is us being in the corner with a line out and then attacking and getting nowhere, which I think we did quite a lot in the first half. We scored 0 points. We were 8-0 down at half time. And I think that was the real low point from an attacking sense. But actually, I think, you know, as James says, to come out with a bonus point in the end was probably the best we were ever going to get out of that game, the way we played. I think we then learnt from that going into the next few weeks, because you saw that it clearly defined that what we wanted to do was, you know, we weren't just going to be a team that took penalties. And it was really frustrating at the time, because we were going, we're not good enough to go to the 5 metre and try and drive over. But actually then go further down the line, we continue with that tactic of, right, we're not going to take the penalty, we're going to go for the corner. And it genuinely starts to deliver results. And the one I'm thinking of, which is probably the two you compare it with, is that Bath game. Because we go to the corner and we need to score a try from a 5 metre line out, and we do. And I think that Saints game is almost the foundation for that, to look at. You know, you don't improve without making the mistake, do you? And that Saints game is certainly the mistake we made, where we just couldn't attack and we couldn't work out how to break down that defence against not a very good defence. You know, Saints' defence is certainly not one of the better ones in the league. So I think it was quite important to kind of have that really frustrating attacking performance, that where we couldn't actually penetrate a defensive line, to then later in the season develop. But yeah, it was a very frustrating game. We've had a lot of frustrating games against Saints over our time, but that one was probably one of the worst, purely for the fact that actually our play wasn't that bad and our performance wasn't that bad, but we just could not score points. And I think that is something that felt like a bit of an issue at the time, and probably has since. We don't quite appreciate how far we've come as a team in quite a short time from that Saints game to the end of the season.
Do you think that is the worst performance of our season then, that Saints game?
I think it probably has to be, doesn't it?
I think you sold me on the Falcons game with them coming in fresh. Yeah. You know, actually, it's not that much of a surprise losing away.
Yeah, because I think Saints weren't in great form either. I'm trying to cast my mind back, but I don't think they were playing well, were they?
I think Edinburgh at home was pretty grim.
Yeah.
Like, you know, with Dimes having gone, I think just the context of that performance was a lot more worrying than the Saints one.
Even the Edinburgh at home game, though, we should have won that by a country mile, because we were up at half time. They hadn't scored at half time. See, you forget how good that first half actually was. The second half of Edinburgh is probably the absolute low point. I think that Saints game for attack was the low point. If you're looking at overall performance, then to be fair, I think you're right. I think Edinburgh probably even pips it, just because that second half so outweighs the first half. It was absolutely dreadful, wasn't it? And I think I just remember watching it thinking, this is what is this club going to become?
12-0 up at half time we were against Edinburgh in hindsight. Yeah.
And what was the final score?
The final score was, hang on, I've lost it now. It was 16-15 to Edinburgh. So they outscored us 16 points to 3 in the second half. Yeah. That is dour. Good call, James. Well, let's not dwell too much on the negatives, actually, because we're going to, the last two topics before we get to the playoffs are actually very, very positive. So these kind of overlap a little bit. So I'm going to start with the bigger hitter, which is the Champions Cup campaign. So obviously, as Alex has already hinted at, very strange year this year. Sale play two games in their pool of eight, lose both of them, and yet somehow still qualify for the round of 16 games, partially due to the fact that the last two pool stage games were cancelled due to COVID restrictions. So actually, Sale then have a back-to-back weekend in April, where they have a round of 16 game against the Scarlets, and then a European Cup quarter-final against La Rochelle. So let's put this in two again. Alex, I'll start with you first. So round of 16 game, Sale beat Scarlets at the Parky Scarlets, 57 points to 14. In terms of the high points of the season, where does that one rank for you?
Honestly, probably the most enjoyable Sale game I've watched for years. And you know, I'm putting it up there with like beating Wasps in the semi-final of the Premiership. Like, just for, I remember just being amazed, thinking this can't be real, but we just started with such ferocity, and I don't think Scarlets knew what to expect. And you know, you think before the game, we were looking at that Scarlets team going, Ken Owens, now a Lion, Jonathan Davies, man of the series for the last two Lions tours, Gareth Davies at nine. They just had such a vast array of talent, and we're a bit of an unknown quantity, and actually were very poor on the day. But I think we, you know, it sort of epitomised everything that we wanted to be. We were up front, we won the collisions, our defence was so aggressive, but then we also executed accurately. And that was the big difference that we hadn't really done until that point, I think. And you know, again, we're talking about that kind of, that Northampton game from an attacking standpoint. This was, you know, and this wasn't even that long after, I don't think, was it? And it was a complete change in, you know, execution, conversion, and you know, it was just so exciting to watch and to do it on the European stage. And, you know, you had, that's always the difference, isn't it? I feel like, you know, if it's a standard Premiership game on like BT Sport 2 Extra, then, you know, we're watching it, but who else is watching it other than the opposing team fans? Whereas this was, a lot of people were watching this, and you know, there were big names, and we just massively impressed. And I think that maybe a little bit as well, you know, you think about how long we performed poorly on BT when we played on Friday night or whatever. To the casual rugby fan, we are a bad team, and I think this was quite nice to show that actually we had something in the locker. And you know, it was sort of the start of AJ playing out of his skin for the rest of the season as well. I think this is a big game for him. Faf really sort of ran it, and then Rafi came on and delivered on again in a big game against big players. So, you know, for me, that was one of the highlights of the season, absolutely. And I just think that scoreline is always exciting when you get to score that many points, because if you're a Quins fan, it probably happens once a month. But for a Sale fan, it happens about once every 3 years. And, you know, the last time we scored that many was that Gloucester game when, again, it was just sort of like, is this real? Like, does Byron McGuigan just intercept every pass Gloucester throw? Huge result, hugely exciting. And I think it got us all quite a bit whipped up, didn't it, for the next week against La Rochelle, and probably some misplaced confidence.
I think when AJ McGinty's scoring a record points haul of 32 points, it's fair to you know, to get that confidence up, which I think, by the way, is a club record in all competitions. 32 points for McGinty on that day down in Wales. And like you said, Alex, you know, round of 16, done and dusted, beat a team chock full of Lions. And then, James, we obviously have to go away to La Rochelle again in the Champions Cup quarterfinal. I mean, obviously, you know, ultimately, La Rochelle beat us quite comprehensively, 45 points to 21. It probably marks the beginning of the Simon Hammersley out campaign with across some Sale fans. But I mean, you know, ultimately, a quarterfinal against a team that had the chance to do the double this year, it kind of felt like that was a perfectly acceptable result in the scheme of things. Do you reckon you agree with that?
Yeah, and it was peak La Rochelle as well, really. I mean, they kind of tailed off a little bit just towards the end of the season. They really should have won that top 14 final against a Toulouse side that, you know, sort of was missing four or five of its best players. But, against us, they were absolutely on form. And, of course, they've been, for the first time, really, a lot of hype about Sale. It was kind of because of that performance the week before at Scarlets. What really played against us, really, was that six-day turnaround. And I just think we talked about it at the time. It's sort of less the physical recovery, although 6 days is tough, but it's the mental recovery. We had to travel down to Southwest Wales during a pandemic, and I'm telling you that takes a long time to get down to Llanelli, and then to go away to La Rochelle, which we also know is quite an inaccessible place at times. You know, I think that actually, you look back and it was very, very unlikely that we were going to go there and win. I think that the score line was appropriate, considering the task that Sale had and the performance that La Rochelle put in on the day.
Still, it's a Champions Cup quarter final, and even though La Rochelle were a little bit too much for us on the day, it was still even the way of actually us getting there was a bit convoluted. It was still amazing to see Sale, you know, not just challenging for the top four in the Premiership, obviously, but also playing meaningful knockout rugby in the Champions Cup. And obviously, with the ERC planning to keep that pool stage format again for next season, it will be interesting to see how Sale go on two fronts as we go into next year. But obviously, you know, even whilst we're having fun in Wales and France, there is a Premiership campaign going on as well. And to kind of almost wrap up the kind of season recap, I've got, well, a third of the season to kind of run through, because it's at this point between March and actually June 2021 that Sale go on an 8-game unbeaten winning streak in the Premiership. So just going to name some of the teams that we knocked off in that time: London Irish, Wasps, Gloucester, Worcester, Leicester Tigers, Bath, Bears, and Quins. And then that streak comes to an end in the final game of the season down at Sandy Park to Exeter. So, James, you know, this is, again, I think, ultimately a club record, the longest winning streak in the Premiership. It surpassed a record from 2005, if I remember correctly. And this was almost the story of our season. You know, it was Axe in charge. He had a massive sort of runway for the end of the season. Sale were playing good rugby. They were beating the teams they were supposed to beat. They were winning at home, winning away, and ultimately, you know, beat the team in first in Bristol, and then obviously beat the team in fourth and ultimate champions Harlequins as well. So, you know, what was, do you think this was kind of the defining point of the season for Sale, the fact that we were just all guns blazing for the final third of the campaign?
I think that's right. But actually, you know, the Scarlets game is where you realised that we had kind of a performance in us with a level of intensity that we as fans could be very confident about, that not many teams could match if we brought it. If we brought that level of intensity for 80 minutes, I don't think only probably Exeter could match us. And when you stop, what was another defining feature of this running actually was the way that Sanderson just kept rotating the team. He kept bringing in the next person to do the job. You know, we saw Doherty play a couple of really big games in this period and put in really good performances. You mentioned like his first appearance under Sanderson, where there'd been a lot of rotation, probably slightly too many, sort of 12, 13 changes for that game. Doherty and Roebuck didn't have good games. You know, Doherty came back really strongly for the majority of this season, just doing the simple stuff really, really well from 12, showing a bit of dynamism, good bit of pace, putting on a bit of weight. And it's people like that just got brought back in. You know, Phillips coming off the bench as like an impact player, he probably didn't see that coming. We probably thought he was probably coming to the end, and with the strength that we have in that position, was he going to get a go? So it was just that trust that he had to trust the next person in that position, do the rotation, trust everybody in the squad, but also pick on form. And obviously, as you go then through, it was almost like, you know, sort of then peaked for the Bristol game at home, and then the Quins game at home, where, you know, at that point, I think it's fair to say that a lot of people were like, that Sale could win the Premiership. And we thought we could probably win, but we always had one eye on where in the top four we were going to finish, knowing that, you know, those back-to-back games against Exeter were going to be a bit of an issue. I know you'll come on to that next, Lewis. But no, that sort of, you know, Quinn sent up a weak side against us and rested. We decided not to rest any players through to this part of the season. But the way we battered them physically, you know, It was just like men versus boys. So, you know, I think we can take away a lot from this run into next season in terms of the level of performance we know we can get to. And hopefully that'll drive the standards in the squad.
Alex, just briefly then, I mean, you've got 8 games to choose from that run. Do any of them in particular stand out as the kind of your favourite or the kind of peak? Because one of the things we haven't mentioned as well is Sale won a load of these games with, despite having to play with 13 men for a sizable chunk of it. So I don't know if that kind of factors into your decision-making at all.
Yeah, well, that Wasps game was just a silly win, wasn't it? I think there were a couple where we showed mental fortitude beyond what we'd ever showed under Dimes, which was the Wasps game, which we should have lost, and go over with a driving maul from Curtis Langdon, I think it's called the try, doesn't it? And again, it comes back to that Saints game. You know, we learned the lessons of being able to score from 5 metres out. And then the Bath game as well, which, you know, both games we probably should have lost in hindsight. And we sort of somehow managed to show some sort of, I don't know where it came from, but it was superb, you know, kind of, as I say, that kind of mental resilience. But the Bristol game has to be the highlight, doesn't it? I think, you know, it's hard to look past that as just, it felt a bit like a complete performance. You know, the first half was just so intense.
I mean, it felt like a test match. Like genuinely, you look at the players who were on both sides and the quality of the performances, it was like watching test rugby.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the kind of, it's the ultimate sort of compliment, isn't it, to a Premiership game, to have that level of intensity. And yeah, if that had been the final, it would have been a deserving final. And it's interesting that obviously neither of those teams then made the final, because it felt like the top two going at each other, didn't it? Which I think it was at the time, or would have been when we finished our game and next year hadn't played. So, you know, that was obviously a highlight for sheer. But you know, when you look at that run, there are a few results where you go, I'll tell you what, we did well to sneak a win there. And think about that Worcester game where we, you know, they should have scored in the last minute and we just kept conceding points. And we only beat Gloucester 25-22, which I'm trying to remember, but I can't even remember the game itself. But, you know, I think that whole run is characterised by a willingness to win and avoiding what we did under Dimes, which was to win one, lose one, win one, lose one. I just flopped back down straight after we'd had a successful game. So, yeah, a lot of highlights, but yeah, I come back to that Bristol game. It was just, and you know, the Watson Bath game for drama, but the Bristol game for the complete intense test match performance, test match animals all over the squad, I think.
So obviously, you know, despite that 8-game winning run, ultimately we're at the end of the season now, and Sale season actually comes to an end with 2 consecutive defeats. The first comes in the very very last game of the season, going down to Exeter, where Sale and Chiefs both elected to play full strength sides. Sale needed a try bonus point and to prevent Exeter from winning, from getting anything from the game to leapfrog them into second. Ultimately, that didn't happen. Exeter finished the season in second. Sale finished third, and that means we have to go away to Sandy Park for a playoff semi-final, and obviously Sale's first playoff game in the Premiership for 15 years. So, Alex, you know, just back to you to kind of kick things off. I mean, we were obviously faced with this, you know, monumental task of having to go down to Exeter twice in consecutive weeks, and, you know, and try and win both times. I mean, ultimately, when you kind of think of Sale's season stopping, you know, at Sandy Park, do you think it was an opportunity missed, or do you think this is kind of the roadblock we have to hit in the evolution of this team from this season?
Oh, 100% the latter. I think, you know, we learned so much from both of those games. I think from the Exeter the first Exeter game, sorry, the both Exeter games, from the first game, the league game, I think it shows that we still have a bit of a way to go to get ourselves clear of teams. You know, we should have got that try bonus point probably in the first half. And yeah, we were playing out of our skin in that first half. It's one of the best halves in rugby I've seen us play all season. So I don't think you can complain. But you know, you then look at letting Exeter back into it. I think we'll learn a lot from. And then the semi final. Do you know? And we haven't spoken since the semi final because obviously I was away. But I think to do what we did with the injuries we had, it's still come within, you know, we still could have won that game right at the death. And we were still in it pretty much up until the last. So I think we have to be massively happy with that, given the players we were missing. And if you look at how, again, that will develop us, I think to compete with Exeter in that semi-final, in a big pressure cooker occasion, away against the reigning champions, and probably the team that we would find it most difficult to beat, in terms of being able to match our intensity and that kind of thing. And to do that without AJ McGinty, to do that without Luke Diago, to do that without someone like Cam Neild, and without Sam James, who was a massive, massive loss just before the game, I think says a lot about, you know, where this squad can go. Because if you add in that top level talent, then it's again, it comes back to, you know, what you said at the start, that this is a massive learning experience and actually I think will hugely benefit us. And you can look back at all those other games where it's quite nice doing this kind of look back and going, oh yeah, that Saints game, that was rubbish, but actually we learned from it. And that La Rochelle game, that was, you know, we got outplayed by a better side, but then how much did that feed into that win against Bristol? You know, having that test match intensity, having that ability to deal with pace and learning how to defend against areas that we are slightly weaker at. So, you know, I think it was obviously tough to take. And for me, the league game is much more tough to take than the semi-final. I think going into the semi-final, my expectations were a bit lower because of who we were missing. Whereas the league game, especially after that first 20 minutes, I thought we could actually do this. And I think we probably should have won it with a bonus point. And then, you know, who knows what would have happened. But I suppose what would have happened is we'd have faced a Quins team who were pretty much unstoppable in the final. It would have been even worse. I'd rather have lost to Exeter away in the semi and have all this chat about learning experiences, in quotation marks, etc., than have lost to Quins at Twickenham in a final and watched them lift the trophy.
It does feel like that. I think, you know, we can console ourselves with this kind of narrative around, yeah, losing away at Chiefs is a learning experience. Whereas if we'd gone to the final and got beat by the team that finished a distant fourth, it would have been a little bit more harrowing. But James, obviously, yeah, this is where the kind of season comes to an end. And, you know, what were your thoughts on those two games against Exeter? And do you agree? Do you believe the narrative that we're selling ourselves, which is that it's all a learning experience for next season?
Yes, I because you have to, and you know, you have to stay positive. I think, you know, a lot of big coaches, they always say you have to take the opportunities when they present themselves, because you don't know when your net's going to get it. You know, rugby is a momentum game. All our good players are suddenly being noticed by international teams now, being selected. So, you know, it's going to test the squad. Saracens are coming back up. So you can't take anything for granted. So you have to approach this as if it might have been the last opportunity. I think I would have sent down a different team to Exeter, still a big physical side with a remit to do a hit job on Exeter, really take a lot out of them physically, and then maybe brought some big players off the bench, you know, either see out a win and take that confidence. But, you know, thinking that the four tries was probably not going to happen. Having said that, I was wrong, because actually the team put themselves in the position where they should have had a home semi-final. And actually that the turning point was obviously the card for Exeter, and then them just turning up the ante and us just not being able to sort of deal with that, because we should have won with a bonus point and had a home semi-final from the position we had ourselves in that game, and then when they got the card. So actually, Sandon was proven right with his selection, and the players, in Sanderson's own words, sort of folded a little bit didn't produce the goods. I think that as soon as that happened, we were never going to win the next week, because we were never going to bring that level of intensity that we'd seen against Bristol, against Quinns, and then at Exeter the week before when we should have won. And by the way, I think we might have snuck that game if we didn't think we had to score another try or whatever, because you approach things a little bit differently, knock over a, you know, drop goal or something. So I just think that that was the moment where we knew we weren't going to win that semi-final, was when Exeter came back at us in that league game. I do think that the Exeter question is an important one, because with Saracens coming up as well, they're going to be two teams that physically can deal with us and can deal with us for 80 minutes of intensity. And we need to find out a different way of beating those sides, because I think that we can work out how to beat Bristol and Quinns and probably a Gloucester and Bath, you know, and some of these other teams. But Saracens and Exeter, you're going to have to do something else. So I think that, you know, looking ahead to our season preview in a few weeks' time, that might be something that we're talking about, like in terms of evolution of how we play. And maybe that's what they'll be working on in pre-season.
So we are at the end of the season. And before we kind of do some awards and have a little bit of a chat about next year, there is one question that I want to put to both of you. So Sale, you know, finished the season. They're a losing playoff semi-finalist, but they finished third in the table. They got through to the quarterfinals of the European Champions Cup. Let's ignore the pool stages. Obviously had a lot of turnover, you know, off the field and behind the scenes. But, you know, James, I'll start with you. I mean, simply, you know, do you consider this season a success for Sale, considering everything that's happened?
Yeah, absolutely. Every single season that we've had since the new ownership come in has been a success. And we've finished higher up the league every single year. Last year, I'm certain we would have finished fourth. And this year, we finished third. Whereas last year, we would have been happy to sneak in the top four, we look like a title contender this year. So, I think that shows a massive improvement. And it does look like, you know, we also evolved our relationship with the media, as I said. Sanderson is loved by the media. Even like sort of reaching out into the community. Got some of our big players playing at their levels of potential that maybe they weren't quite under Diamond. Still a few question marks here or there, of course. There's areas for improvement, of course. And you'd be worried if there wasn't. Because if this is the peak, then that'll be a shame. I think the team's got more to go. So definitely a success. No question for me.
And so, Alex, I mean, same question for you. I mean, do you consider the season to have been a successful one?
100%. And I think beyond, when you take into account where we were at the start of it, I think, you know, what we expected this season when we started it with Dimes at the helm was we'll get to the top four and we'll maybe finish fourth. And I think when Dimes left, we said, didn't we, you know, it'll be a massive achievement to even get top six probably at this point. So hugely, hugely successful. And I think the good thing is that, as James says, I think there is another level to go to. And I do think when you look at what we've kind of the sea change in the coverage of us as a club from sort of northern underdogs, win at home, tough to beat, to genuine Gallagher Premiership powerhouse. You know, no team wants to play us now. No team ever used to want to play us, but it never got talked about. Now, no team wants to play us. And it's not just because we're horrible and nasty and we're hard to beat. It's because we've also got threats all over the pitch. So I think it massively successful season. I think it'll be a real challenge next season to do the same. You know, I think you look at who's coming up and there are certain teams who we kind of know where this season and probably will come back next season and be stronger. It'll be a huge challenge, but I think we are so well placed and, you know, imagine giving Alex Sanderson a full pre-season. If that's what he can do with coming in at the last minute and, you know, having half a season with a squad he hasn't built, give him a full season, a full pre-season, a bit of influence over signings. It's massively exciting, isn't it? And just to a slight personal one, every year I have this, should I renew my season ticket? And every year I obviously do, but every year I sort of go, oh, the AJ Bells are a pain in the ass to get to, and it's always unenjoyable. This year, as soon as it came out, I went, I'm renewing that, and I'm definitely going, and I cannot wait to be there and watch it. And I think that's such a change for me to kind of go from, oh, I'm going because of sports sale and it's a bit of a burden because it's going to be really, I'm going to be stressed out and I'm not going to enjoy it, to now going, God, I want to go and watch Manu Till and Jean-Luc Debrier and Faf de Klerk. And, you know, I just think that hopefully that also filters down to other fans, because, you know, those fans are a bit more casual than maybe, you know, go to a couple of games. Hopefully there is a bit more pull now to override the stadium's pain in the arse to get to, and, you know, all the other issues around the AJ Bell. Hopefully there is a bit of a, you know, and hopefully that translates through to crowds and stuff with the access to the Trafford Centre and that kind of thing. So it's a very exciting place to be in going into next season.
Yeah, and the other thing I just want to say as well is that the other success of this season, and maybe it segues into the next section for you, Lewis, is Sanderson has managed the squad in a way that's deepened it, and deepened it in a very short space of time with the same player pool. So I know that sounds a bit crazy, but what Diamond used to do was have a first choice 23, and some of the bench players might sub in sometimes to play the odd game. But it was basically a squad of 23, and then you add like 15 kids, and every now and again we'd play the 15 kids together away from home at, like, you know, Exeter, and we'd concede like a load of points, and it wouldn't have been a brilliant learning experience for them, or away from home at like Toulon or something, right? Whereas this season, what he's done is he's deepened the squad by selecting these guys alongside some big performers. And he's just trusted them to say, you're the next person in the squad in that position, you will play. And so you're suddenly in a position, and we'll get onto this, I'm sure, with young player of the year discussion, because suddenly you've got these players and you're not worried about them playing. Okay, you might be worried about them playing altogether, but you're genuinely not worried about them playing. I thought that Doherty selection at 12, you know, towards the end of the season, was like, wow, I think it was the Bristol game, wasn't it, at home? And it was like, what's going on here? I thought we'd be, you know, what was happening to Manu and, you know, Van Rensburg, and even other than that, you'd be thinking Luke James or whatever. No, he's the next person, the squad comes in, does a really good job. So the deepening of that squad is very, very important. As I mentioned earlier, internationals getting called up. These players are going to be starting for sale a lot next season. So if we're going to win the Premiership, they're going to be a big part of that.
I think that the one final thing I want to say on kind of the season as a whole, it's actually something that I mentioned when I went on the Bristol fans podcast, because they were asking about, okay, how have things changed since Alex Sanderson came in? And Alex, to your point, I think what we have to remember is this season was unequivocally a success, you know, first playoff appearance 15 years, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's also worth remembering that with everything that happened at the beginning of the season, Sanderson coming in, first head coach, first DOR role, I should say, you know, a squad that wasn't built by him. I think it's important to recognise that a successful season would have been finishing sixth this year, genuinely. The fact that we've had all this off-field turmoil, the fact that you've got basically a brand new coaching staff, given that it's the person right at the top that's changed. I think if we'd snuck into sixth and we had European Champions Cup rugby next year, and I know it's gone to 8 teams, but, you know, if we were a top six team again and we were showing a good bit of form towards the end of the season and we could look to be building towards next year, I still think that qualifies as a good season. If Diamond had been in charge, anything less than top four wouldn't have been a successful season, but we have to change our criteria based on what's happened. And given that we've had the biggest off-field shake-up in a decade, I think it's important to recognise. So not only has it been a successful season and Sanderson has met our expectations, he's absolutely smashed through them. And to James's point, you're now looking at next season and thinking, if this team's got another 20%, 30%, or to Alex's point, you know, Sanderson has a full pre-season with them, what is the next step? And, you know, we'll talk very briefly about expectations right at the end. But I think it's just a very exciting time to be a Sale fan. Because of just how well this season has gone. So with that all in mind, let's wrap up this season with some end of season awards. Always important to do, just to make sure we're giving people the credit they deserve. So we'll build up to this, and I will start with probably the most inconsequential one, which is try of the season. And James, before we started recording, you told me you had a good one in the bank, so I'm gonna come to you first.
Yeah, it was the only one. It's the one that just sprung to mind. I think it was the Falcons game, and we passed the ball out wide, which, you know, was like, this doesn't happen very often, and we have Beaumont going down the wing. And he passes it inside to McGinty, who has that absolutely outrageous flick out of the back of his hands to Lou Diago, who then scores. And I think that was also the game where you were like, come on, Lou Diago's just, I mean, he's on a different planet to every other player that I've ever seen as well. So I think there was those two things. So for me, that was the try of the season, just to see two locks in a move out wide and scoring in the corner.
I'm gutted because I was really struggling to think of one. And that was the one that I came to as like, yeah, brilliant. And James has already beaten me to it. Two things on that try. Yeah, it's the first, it's the inside-out play. Sorry, three things. It's first, it's the inside-out play, like you said. The second is that ridiculous offload from McGinty, which is a sublime bit of skill that wouldn't look out of place in Super Rugby. And also, I think it's finally, it's Lou Diago with the ball in his hands doing the little sidestep right at the end to try and gain an extra couple of yards to go inward. And make the conversion kick a little bit easier. I thought, you know, it's little moments of quality like that, which is why Diaga's a World Cup winner. Alex, what was your try of the season?
For me, it is the JP Dupree try against Bath, which starts with a line out on our 22 and features McGinty's best piece of skill of the season for me, which is the through the legs pass to Sam Hill. And then we just go like length of the field, don't we? It was just absolutely superb. And I think what was really good is that we've never really seen us score kind of 80-metre tries before. And I know we took a couple of phases, but it was just the then execution to lob the ball over the top to JP Dupree in the wide channel to score it. But yeah, purely for the AJ McGinty through the legs pass, it has to be that one for me.
I mean, the only other one I could think of is also a bit of AJ McGinty skill, which is the try he scored against Scarlets, where De Klerk rushes out of the line to charge down to put pressure on the ball player. The ball is a long lofted pass; it's going absolutely nowhere. And as it's coming down, McGinty runs onto it, kicks it through with a lovely bit of footballing skill, and then regathers it to go under the post. So it's interesting that AJ is featuring so prominently in all of these, but it's you know, it speaks to the fact that we've got a bit of consistency with our playmakers.
The other one I thought of, which isn't, I didn't say because it's a bit, you know, I'm a back and therefore I have to choose that Bath one. But the one against Bath, when not necessarily for it being a good try, but for being a try of the season, when Tom Curry is just pounding the floor after we've gone over that driving ball. That was one try where I just was off my feet in my living room going absolutely nuts. And that doesn't happen that often. So, yeah, I think that one just as a moment was great, but as a try, probably not that exciting given it was just a rolling ball that went over.
Is it worth saying at this point that we'll put the like three or four options up on Twitter as normal, Alex, and give our fans the final say? Well, not our fans, our listeners. We're not arrogant enough to think they're fans, but they will listen to us babbling on for an hour and a half. You guys will have the final choice, of course.
So moving on then to what I've got down as game of the season, but I think if you want to call it kind of team performance of the season, that's absolutely fine. So Alex, you know, you can go first this time.
So game of the season, there's a few, I think there's a couple of obvious ones which we've talked about. So I will be, I'm going to go for Bristol Bears away. Because when we beat them 2013 and Nick James scores in the corner, I think it was just so, I mean, for a Bristol fan, it was probably so frustrating to watch. But as a Sale fan, it was the first proper complete performance we'd seen for a long time where, you know, we just completely shut them down. And I remember being so terrified before the game going, God, Bristol are going to run from anywhere. And actually, I think we've seen now that our defensive system is very well suited to their attack. But at the time, I was thinking this could be a, you know, cricket score. So yeah, I'll go for Bristol away, Luke James scoring in the corner, and Dan Thomas throwing his toys out the pram and beating Pat Lamb. Absolutely, hook it to my veins.
I actually had Bristol away as my performance of the season as well. I think the win at home, obviously, is the best game I've seen all year, because like I said, it's like watching a test match. But that was the first time where we kind of saw, under Sanderson as well, this team put together a complete performance. And admittedly, it was only his second game. But you just looked at how we played and how we shut down Bristol, who were like the Harlem Globetrotters up until that point. And it was just like, okay, something's changed in this team. You know, we've completely outplayed them. And again, it kind of reestablished ourselves as actually, yeah, we know we're a top four contender. You know, everyone is rightly so talking about Bristol, you know, being this amazing team that's going to win it all. And we just kind of went down to their barn and just completely shut them down, and we're deserving winners. And I think, you know, that was a sign ultimately of things to come, that you can chuck the Wasps game where we play with 13 men in there, Bristol at home, etc. But I think, I think it was that game where you're like, that's a complete performance. And actually, it was the first time we'd seen, okay, this squad that Diamond's built, what happens if we put another 10% on top of it? And that's exactly what we can do. So I've got that one down. James?
Scarlets, for me, I just think, just to completely blow them off the park, was a shock to all of us. We've all got it in living memories of having like Scarlets in, you know, Challenge Cup groups or whatever, and just losing home and away. And so to just go down there and just against expectation as well. No one expected us to do it. We were lucky to be there. And for it to be a non-contest, it was nice.
I think over the course of our conversation, there's another category that's come up that I'm going to throw to you guys as a bit of a curveball, which is actually our kind of worst game of the season. Just whilst, you know, we've got to stay humble as Sale fans. It's great talking about the good stuff, but we've got to think about, you know, where we've come from. So since I've dropped this one on you without a moment's notice, I'll kind of go first. My sort of worst game of the season as a Sale fan was Quinn's away. Just because obviously, you know, Sanderson's come in, you know, we're everyone's feeling good. Admittedly, we lost about the week before. And it was kind of the antithesis of the Bristol game where we just shut them down, where it was Quinn's, everything they tried came off. Everything we tried just didn't work. And we just looked shell-shocked, completely blown out of the water. And I think it's interesting that we talk about the playoffs and the fact that our defensive system works really well against Bristol, because although they throw it around and play from anywhere, it is very well structured, whereas Quins are a little bit more off the cuff. It's a little bit more about individual skill at 9 and 10. 8, 9 and 10, I should say. And actually, it's been proven that we're not necessarily a great match for that. So I think if we're thinking about where we go next season, you probably want to avoid Quins, because they could do to us, again, what they did to us last season, which I thought was actually probably our worst performance of the season, given where we ended up. James, have you got a worst performance of the season?
Yeah, it's the week before that against Bath. Again, the Sanderson era had started. We all had all the hope. And what I mentioned, I'll mention it because it very rarely happens, but what I said in the match preview actually happened. Bath played in exactly that way, and the people that I mentioned ended up scoring and ripping us to pieces. And to lose at home to Bath, who, you know, what was just a massive blow, and it did make you think, oh, okay, you know, we're not what we were going to hope to be under Sanderson. But of course, with hindsight, he didn't have anywhere near enough time to make that personal impact. So yeah, those two games together, I agree, were kind of where someone had burst our balloon. But fortunately, someone pumped it back up again to the end of the season. But where are you, Alex?
Well, I'll be obvious and go for Edinburgh at home. Just for pure frustration. But no, I agree. I think, personally, Quinn's away, worst game of the season, because I hate losing to Quinn's. And yeah, it's the one where you were like, oh, there's just nothing we can do to stop this. Is the, you know, we just don't have the skill set and the level to stop it. So that was quite despondent. And Bath, yeah, just they are rubbish. And Stuart Hooper isn't a very good coach, and yet we end up losing. It's less than ideal. So I completely agree with your choices. But yeah, I think the dark days of watching us concede 16 points in the second half against a dreadful Edinburgh team will not be forgotten for some time.
Right, individual awards now. So we've got two here, and we'll start off with the kids. Young Player of the Year, Alex. And obviously, just by the way, the criteria for this is just common sense, you know. So we're not using like age brackets or anything like that.
I've gone 23 and under, though, just so you know.
If the criteria is common sense, then there's only one answer. So there's no point even you two nominating because it's clearly Rafi Quirk. So let's just stop it there.
Why Rafi Quirk then?
Because he's just the best player that's ever played the Fail Shines. No, he's just so exciting to watch. And I think he brings a dynamism and a level of pace and a level of quick thought to our game that is completely unrivaled in our squad. You know, he's faster than most of our back three. He thinks so quickly. But then also, he's about 12. But he's built like, you know, he shouldn't be built like that for how fast he is. And also his basics are so, so good. You know, his box kicking is excellent. His passing is honestly, I think his passing might be better than Faf's. I know Faf can do the magic pass, but when Rafi passes it, it goes into the breadbasket. Someone's running onto it. They take it at pace and they hit the line. You know, Faf's can be in front of you, behind you. You know, they're always going to be going to the right place, but the actual quality of technical passing, I think Rafi's is insane. And, you know, just for how young he is and the impact he's had on games, to come in and do that, I think he's been absolutely incredible. And I think it's probably the best or the most impact a young player has had since the Currys came in. You know, just for performing at a first team level at that age.
I think, I've got Rafi Quirk as well. And it's for that reason, which is you see every so often you see players come in at 19, 20, make an impact, and you think, okay, they're going to play 50 games for England, you know, guaranteed. We saw it with the Currys in 2015-16, and it's the same with Quirk. It's just, you know, at 20 years old, he looks not just like he's ready to play Premiership rugby, but he looks like he can be a difference maker at this level already. And I think, you know, like you said, the basics are there. He's got that X factor that we do miss, you know, across the squad. And the fact that he's kind of come in and made and just, you know, not necessarily set the world alight every single game, but he's just had solid 7 out of 10 performances for his first 10 first team appearances, I think is indicative of, just what an exciting player he is. And I think the impact he's made is a testament to that. James?
Well, I think there's a massive caveat to what you both say on Rafi Quirk, which is, you know, he started one Premiership game in his career. And, you know, it is one thing making a big impact, which I completely agree with off the bench. And I also agree that he's going to play for England and he's very, very exciting. But I think it's very, very different to packing down at 20 years of age and starting nearly every single game of the season. And for me, it has to be Bevan Rodd by quite a big distance. I know that he sort of got found out a bit by Exeter last two games of the season, but you know, you can't always be remembered for your last match, and you have to, we're looking at the whole season here, and I think that Bevan Rodd is considerably ahead of Rafi Quirk in that instance. And I think that if Curtis Langdon maybe just sneaks in as well, like he probably is also ahead of Quirk, but we're quite blessed at the moment. You know, we've had quite a few players who are young and come and done a good job. Doherty Reid this year has had a massive step forward. Huge. Probably our most dangerous back three player now and can score tries. So this category has quite a lot of choices, I think. I'm sure there'll be quite a range of views. I think Quirk is the champagne choice, which is why I'm not surprised that you two chose him. But you know that anybody with any sensible view will see that Rod is by far the best person for.
Nobody pays money to go and see Loosehead Props play. That's the way I look at it. and I'm someone who thinks, you know, the sun shines out of Bevan Rodd's arse. I think he's an incredible player, but ultimately you got to go with the sexy pick sometimes.
you go for the sexy pick every time.
Very true. All right, final award then, which is obviously player of the year. James, you know, who was your pick? And also, just by the way, as a caveat, last year all three of us had Dan Dupria as our unanimous player of the year.
And I think that Dan is an option again this year. I was surprised that the club didn't put him forward to the fans as an option. There was some odd other picks to choose from there. I don't think Faf or Aka hit the heights that we would have wanted them to. I think there's quite a few players that you could choose from to give our listeners options, but I think Jean-Luc Dupreuil was just outrageous for the majority of the season. Certainly since Sanderson came in, at second row and at six and at eight, played at a very, very high level. So Jean-Luc for me.
Alex?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think Jean-Luc has been another level. And, he's been like international class, hasn't he? He's bouncing off Nathan Hughes and stuff. It's superb to watch. And no one can tackle it. No one's physically dominated him. Teams have physically dominated us, but no one's physically dominated him. And I think he's just taken all of those silly errors out of his game, which has taken him to the level that he is at now. So, yeah, completely agree. For me, obviously, I'm going to pick a back because I don't understand the scrum, which is why I didn't pick Bevan Roth.
No. Raffy Kirk sweep of young player and player of the year.
Yes, correct. No, I think for me, AJ McGinty has just obviously been incredible. And the one thing that has frustrated me about AJ this year, and it's not about him, it's about the media, is that they keep referring to him as the most improved player. He's not been that much better this year than he ever has been. He's just played more, and people have been watching us because Sanderson's been our coach.
And he's surrounded by better players, Alex, isn't he? I mean, that's the thing. But he's playing at the same level. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, what a brilliant season.
Unbelievable. And I think what he's done this season is really kind of honed those attacking... he always had that attacking skill in him, but you can see the confidence he's playing with. Those things we talked about before, the through the legs against Bath, the round the back against Falcons, some of the passes he's throwing over. And I think that game against Exeter, or that first half against Exeter right at the end of the season, just summed him up. There's the cross kick to Sam James, which is executed to perfection right in the first minute. There's the little kick through to Aaron Reid for his try. And he was doing it against, he was doing it early in the season, like that Bristol away game, the pass to Luke James. He's just making perfect try-scoring opportunities and perfect try-scoring chances week in, week out at the moment. He's kicking his goals at a ridiculous percentage. His defence is, as always, superb. I think he was an absolute level above, and I think he was our biggest miss for the semi-final by a country mile for me. Has to be AJ.
I agree with Alex here. I think I've got AJ, unsurprisingly, as my player of the year. I think Jean-Luc is probably a very close second because of how much his game has changed and how important he's become, playing across multiple positions as well. But I think when you look at AJ, you look at the difference between our squad this year and last year and our performances this year and last year, and one of the massive caveats of that has been the improved play of McGinty. He's the sort of primary playmaker more. We're playing off 10 a lot more than we've ever done in the past, instead of off De Klerk. And you're seeing improvements in his game. His kicking out of hands improved significantly. His passing's improved. As Alex said, everything else around his game has continued to shine. And I think actually when you look at why if Sale made that jump this year, I think Jean-Luc's a big part of that, but we are blessed with so many good back rowers that his influence is probably slightly less than someone like McGinty, where he's shown probably for the first time that we can have confidence that this is a team that can win a Premiership title with McGinty at 10. And that seems insane to say, because obviously he won the Pro 12 as it was then with Connor, but you always got the kind of sense that if we get to the Premiership semi-finals, is 10 going to be the one area where we don't necessarily have that player who can push us onwards? And it kind of feels like now McGinty has just kind of blown that out of the water, and he's just been superb all season. And as Alex mentioned, was a huge miss in that playoff defeat.
We do need a third choice for that though, because it'll stress my OCD out if we have only two choices for the last award. Unless you think that those two are absolutely country mile player, in which case I can live with it.
I think that Dan Dupreuil has got to be there. I mean, his consistency of performances. And the other player that I'd like to throw out there, again, like his defence every now and again was a bit dodged, but I think huge credit this year has to go to Marlon Yard.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm really surprised that the club didn't put him up for player of the season. He scored tries for us. His kick chase game has gone to a completely different level. His commitment, at least in defence, And to come back from that injury, I mean, at the beginning of this season, we were questioning whether he would be still here at the end of the season. And now he's first choice winger. And yeah, if we're looking for a third one that's maybe different from what the club have put forward, he could be an option.
I'd like to second that, because I think in terms of actual on-field performances, I think, you know, Tom Curry is a cut above, you know, 95% of players in world rugby. But, you know, he's only played X amount of games this year and has obviously been away with England and injuries and all that kind of stuff. Whereas Yard, for the most part, has played every week and has just been so consistent and so strong. His defensive game has improved dramatically and has gone from a bit of a weakness to a strength. And again, I think he's a player where you've seen the impact of Sanderson like immediately. But, you know, I think if you're looking for, you know, holistically, he's been our most impressive players. I'd certainly back Marlon Yard for that.
Yeah, I would also say that as well. I think you're right on that. Things like the kick chase is just, he's taken that to another level, and it's a weapon now, isn't it, that we can use. I think he's been brilliant. And to be fair, you know, when we get down to this kind of, you know, I think arguably AJ and John Luke are the standouts, but when you get down to this kind of level, there are so many people you can talk about. I think Byron McGuigan has been outstanding in the latter part of the season. He hasn't played enough to get into that kind of, I should say, that Yard has played all season, but McGuigan coming back at the end of the season was brilliant. You know, Aka van der Merwe, we haven't, I mean, if we were doing a most improved, which we won't, but, you know, his line out throwing has been just another level, and he's still kept all the other areas of his game. Another level from where it was. It's still not as good as Curtis Langdon's, but, you know, I think he's so impactful.
Yeah, and Curtis Langdon's had a good season, and Kovacs Visa, absolutely. There's loads of things you start.
I think that's probably part of the point, is that, you know, when you look at our season, yes, you can pick out a couple of individuals, but actually the whole team has raised their game massively, and we are now, you know, that's why we don't dominate like the stats charts, because the whole team is, and the whole squad is performing actually. So, you know, we're not like making the most tackles. We've not got like a John O'Ross making the most tackles because we're rotating people. And we've not got like, you know, someone scoring a load of points because we're just getting loads of people through the team. So that's probably a wider point. But yeah, I 100% agree with Marlon Yard. And great to see him getting a 2-year contract extension, because as James said, you know, it was, will he be here at the end of the season? Well, sticking around for 2 years and doing great things on and off the field. So.
Right. Well, I think that's just about the season. Can I ask whether you two boys have 5 more minutes to do a little end-of-season quiz?
Absolutely, mate.
We're bringing it back. It's been a long time since we've done one of these quizzes, but I thought we've just been chatting about the season that was for 90 minutes. We've done, I think it's about 40 podcasts this year. You know, we've obviously spent a lot of time talking about the season, and I thought I'd be remiss not to test your knowledge. So I've just got 5 questions, and obviously, you know, we want our listeners to you know, to play on at home as well. So, if you're both ready, I can start off with question number 1. Let's test that knowledge. So, question number 1, who was Sale's top Premiership try scorer this season with 9 tries? I think this quiz is going to be reasonably hard.
Yeah, no, that's good. I don't know, but I've guessed.
Okay, right. Question number 2. So, AJ McGinty scored the most individual points this season with 188. That's just in the Premiership, by the way. But how many points did Kieran Wilkinson score for Sale this year in all competitions?
Okay, I've got a guess. Yeah, I thought he was superb in the semi-final when he came on, by the way. Irrelevant, but very exciting future with Quirk and Wilkinson at 9 and 10.
So 188 for AJ. How many points did Kieran Wilkinson score? Cool. Question number 3. So obviously the squad on the field didn't change that much this year, but how many players made their debut for Sale this season? And that debut could have come in any competition. So I'm just looking for the number, but obviously, when we do the answers.
Sorry, mate, can you repeat that? You cut out for me. Question number 3 was?
Yeah, how many players made their debut for Sale this season in any competition? So it's first team debut. I'm just looking for the number.
Okay, I've got a guess.
It's hard because some of the players had, you know, a handful of appearances in the Anglo-Welsh 2 years ago, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Cool. You got an answer, James? Question number four. Who scored the first try of Sale's season?
That was a long time ago, wasn't it? Again, I've got a guess, but I'm not confident in it.
I should say this is obviously the first Premiership game rather than pre-season. I don't even think we had a pre-season friendly this year. Right. And then the final question, we've done an hour 35 and there's not been any kit chat, which is an absolute travesty. So Sale announced a new sponsor for the primary slot on the shirt this year. But who was the primary sponsor on Sale's home and away shirts this season? Just looking for the name or the text that was on the front of the shirt. So we moved away from UK Fast, got an exciting new sponsor on a very crowded kit. That was not good.
It's the only way you can sneak kit chat in, isn't it? To do a quiz and put a question about kit in. Right.
Absolutely.
Okay. I have a guess.
Yeah, we've watched, God knows.
It's going to be embarrassing when I get 0 out of 5 on this quiz and we've just spent an hour 40 talking about season, isn't it?
I just think, you know, we watched so many minutes of Sale this year, you would have thought the kit sponsor would be ingrained in your mind. But anyway, right, you ready, Francis? So question number one, who was Sale's top Premiership try scorer this season with 9 tries? Alex?
I've guessed Acker van der Merwe.
And James?
I thought it'd be McGuigan or Yard. I've gone McGuigan.
James, you are correct. It's Byron McGuigan. 9 tries in the Premiership this season.
That's impressive given that he barely played.
I did not realise he'd scored 9 tries at all. So fair play to him.
Well, he scored at least 4 interceptions. So
James is 1-0 up. Question number 2. AJ scored the most individual points season with 188, but how many points did Kieran Wilkinson score? James?
Four or seven.
Well, you've got to pick one.
7.
Okay, and then Alex?
I think 3. I think he just kicked a penalty, and I might be wrong. I think it's really low.
So we'll go closest to the pin here. Kieran Wilkinson scored 4 points for Sale this season.
Oh, James.
So
that was my other option.
So Alex takes it because he went with 3. And that's obviously closest.
Yeah, fine.
It's question number 3. How many players made their debut for Sale this season in any competition? Alex?
I could only think of a very small number, so I've gone with 2. I might be completely wrong.
Okay. And James?
I've gone 3.
James is correct. 3 players made their first team debut for Sale this year. James, I'm going to give you the chance. Can you name any of the 3?
I went Sam Dugdale. Does that know if that's one of them?
No, it isn't.
Brilliant. I've got Raffy.
Yeah, I have Raffy.
Raffy Quirk is one of them.
That's definitely one of them. James Harper.
James Harper is correct. So that's 2.
Yeah, they were the 3. So I got Sam Dugdale wrong. So there's a 3rd one, which I didn't get, but I still got the right number.
Alex, any idea who the 3rd was?
The 3rd one.
Tom Roebuck.
Tom Roebuck. Season, didn't he? I think Doherty played under Diamond, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah.
I didn't know whether it was a signing, but I couldn't remember if we'd signed anyone. I'd like Cobus Beater in the head, but I think he might have played last season, and everything's blended into one.
The answer was JP De Bria.
Oh, of course, yeah. It was a signing, then.
It was a signing, joined mid-season.
Fair play.
Cobus Visa had a couple of games in the back end of last season, so which is the 2019-20 season.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So, and question number 4, who scored Sale's first try of the season? It came against Northampton Saints. Alex?
Sean Luke, potentially.
I've gone for Acker.
James is right with Acker van der Merwe.
I remember.
Great little play off the top of the line. Now, Ben, I think it's Ben Curry with the inside pass to Acker, and he runs in.
Yeah.
And runs over someone as well. So I think, James, you've got 3 points now.
Yes.
And Alex has got one.
Unassailable lead. Yeah. Unassailable.
let's see who likes Kit Chat more, though. So last question. Who was the primary sponsor, so new for the season, on sales home and away shirts this year?
Presumably,
James.
Sorry,
Alex, what were you going to say?
Given this is the most important question, it's worth 3 points. I'm just assuming.
that is definitely correct.
Not so, that I've got
James, wrong. Primary shirt sponsor.
Is Fee Code?
I've said Fee Code as well.
Alex?
Yeah,
I've said... You're both correct. It is Fee Code.
It sticks in my mind just because it was an odd one. And the ladies is something different, isn't it?
Bowl Foods for the women's team.
Bowl Foods.
Yeah. Apparently the world's first interactive, like, primary sponsor. So I remember in the presser, they said, you know, you'd be able to scan it and get exclusive content throughout the season. I don't know if anyone ever actually did scan the Q code, a V code. Here we are. But, I mean, so well done, James. You're the master of this this year. Commiserations, Alex. We'll do it again next year and see if you can come back. So that is the end of season review done. That is the end of our season as well. So just want to take this opportunity to say massive thank you to everyone who started listening to us in November 2020 and stuck with us through to July 2021. Thank you to everyone who supports the podcast on Patreon. As you will see on Twitter, we are releasing this to our Patreon subscribers first with a bit of early access before rolling out to the main listener base. So massive thank you to everyone who's been supporting the podcast there. We really appreciate it. Thank you to everyone who sent in 3-word reviews. Thank you to everyone who's engaged with us on Twitter, corrected things we've got wrong, like we got Kieran Wilkinson's age wrong the other day. You know, it's you guys that obviously make this pod worth doing and obviously keeping us on our toes as well. So a massive thank you to everyone. Thank you to Alex and James for joining me as well for another season. Looking forward to doing it again next year. And then for one last time, I'm going to open the floor to you boys and say, you know, is there anything else you want to tail off before we sign off for the season?
I just want to say, you know, I know it's been tough out there for everyone not being able to go and support the lads. But we got back in, didn't we, to some extent towards the end of the season. Hopefully that's now a sign of things to come. And if we're on for another good season next year, we can all share in it a little bit more and be there live and all together and have a few beers and et cetera. And I think that will improve the experience. It's a shame in some ways that, you know, we weren't able to kind of have like a full home crowd or whatever this season. But next season, fingers crossed.
Yeah, absolutely echo that. Can't wait to be back in the Sharkey with you boys, standing, drinking a pint before beating everyone in the league, winning the league. And we'll see you at Twickenham in June 2022, eh?